Time for us to begin this morning. Good to see each of you here. It's a beautiful day out, and it's good to be together to study God's Word. We're going to be studying from Acts, the 27th chapter. We'll begin in verse 30. Text will be on the screen. You're welcome to open your Bible. If you need a copy of the outline, you raise your hand. We'll get one to you. Acts 27th chapter. That's a lavender or pink sheet. Anybody need a copy of it? Now, we've got Paul aboard ship. He's in the Adriatic Sea. They're approaching the island of Miletus or Malta. They've been in a storm. You're going to find as we study this morning, they've been in that storm probably for at least 14 days. As they've been in the storm, they have thrown certain things overboard. They still have the cargo of the ship, I believe, as you will see today. I'll give biblical evidence for believing that. But as they have been together on the ship, there's been, you've got several different groups of individuals. You've got people that have paid for their travel. You've got prisoners. You've got Roman soldiers. You've got the crew of the ship itself. So as we come to verse 30, the shipmen here are going about to flee the ship. They boarded a boat. They're going to go down into the boat. They've given the idea that they're going down to attach the foreship to anchors, to try to hold the foreship where it is. They've already cast four anchors out of the stern trying to hold the ship to keep it from being cast upon the rocks in the middle of the night. Now, as these shipmen have given this sign that they're going to go out and do this, it's a pretense. It's a matter of fact is they've done it under this pretense to be able to get all of them in the boat to get away from the ship. Their intent is to cut loose from the ship and to leave the ship stranded. And Paul approaches this and addresses it. You see his address in verse 31. Paul said to the centurion, to the soldiers, except these abide in the ship, ye cannot be saved. Now, Paul had already talked to them about the fact that there was a way that they could be saved. And here these shipmen are about to depart from the ship. And Paul just tells the centurion, if you're going to be saved, you've got to keep these people in the ship also. And here Paul is seems to be very brief in what he has to say about the matter. Verse 32, then the soldiers cut off the ropes of the boat and let her fall off. Now, let's talk about what happens here. Who's really in a ship, who's in charge? The captain of the ship. And no doubt here, as the shipmen were boarding this boat, probably under the guidance of the captain, you have something very significant take place here. When these soldiers cut this boat off and let this boat crash to the sea and separate from the ship, you have a military takeover of the ship. No longer is that captain and his crew over that ship, but now the centurion, the captain of the Roman contingent, has taken control of the ship. And this by this action, he's obviously done that. He's obviously gone against the crew of the ship to do what this action has been. Now then, the interesting thing is, what causes him to take such an action? He listened to Paul. Now, if we go all the way backwards and back up for a few days here, back up nearly a couple of weeks, what did Paul tell that centurion at that time and that captain? If you sail away from the island of Cyprus, you're going to be a disaster. All that are boarded are impossible for harm from the things that would take place, the storms that would take place. And they did not listen to him. Well, now you've got this centurion, and this centurion listens to what Paul has said on this matter. That tells you something. Somewhere over the period of the last 2 weeks, this centurion has gained a confidence somewhat in Paul, some way. And again, Paul has done nothing but simply basically demonstrate Christian values during this week. And again, you have this aspect of this change of takeover. And this is going to make a big difference in the outcome of this. All right, so they let the boat. By the way, that's a that word for boat there is a Greek term that's specific for a small boat, a launch, a boat that's carried by a large ship. It's not the same term that we've seen for ship here all the way through. And that's a very interesting study in and of itself, if you just like something for interest, because there's times that Jesus and his apostles went across the Sea of Tiberias or the Sea of Galilee. And it's interesting because sometimes they took shipping and sometimes they took a boat. And sometimes when it's talking about the storm at sea, it's interesting to see whether they're talking about them being aboard a ship or aboard a boat. And so these different terms are used all the way through the New Testament, especially through the biographies, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So just notice that sometime in your study. All right, so once they've let this boat fall off, verse 33, and while the day was coming on, you're in the middle of the night now, the storm's still raging, Paul besought them to take meat, and in that word meat, there's a generic word, it means to eat. I think you'll see it's probably not meat they're eating. It says, take meat, saying the day, this day is the 14th day that ye have tarried and continued fasting and have taken nothing. Now, it's difficult to tell exactly what the 14-day measures here. Evidently, it's 14 days since they have been in the heat of the storm and they've not eaten. I don't know if that's 14 days from the island, but we know they hadn't left the island long before the storm hit them. So, but anyway, he talks about the 14 days here that they've tarried. Now, in that he approaches them for they have continued fasting and taken nothing, it seems to be the idea is they have not eaten as a person should eat, is what's been talked about here. 14 days of total fasting and total drinking nothing would bring a person to what? Okay, and would not be able to be the crew of a ship doing the things that were talked about being done here. But there's no doubt that what he is addressing to them, they are in a weakened condition by the fact that they have not eaten properly or drunk. What's kept them from eating and drinking? Huh? Storm? How has the storm kept them from eating? Some of them been busy. How's it kept them from eating? All right, the very physical aspect of the role of the sea on the ship and the stomach. And fear. I think fear comes in this. Do you not think for a moment that these men have not been afraid? I mean, when they're wanting to get out in that stormy sea on that little boat to get away from that ship, doesn't that tell you they've been afraid of something? And when they think that they're better off in that little boat trying to get to land rather than staying on board the ship, that says they're afraid of something. And so you've seen this picture of fear all the way through here. So fear has kept them from eating. The physical aspects kept them from eating. The storm itself being busy. So they've just simply not eaten properly. And Paul here beseeches them to take some food, to take a meal, eat and drink, nourish the body back up to where it needs to be. Proper advice. What would cause Paul to tell these men to do that? He knew something they didn't know about what was coming. That's true. What would cause him to tell them to do that? He's gotten information from God. But what would cause him to tell these fellas to huh? It would build them up back to their confidence. That's right, they're going to have their strength, Daniel. That's true. He had an eye, a mind, that was concerned for the other person. A lot of people would have been on board ship, and you know what their main thought would have been? How do I take care of myself? Now, Paul had a little better advice. I mean, actually, his concern for them also was a concern for the whole, because he knew that shipmen needed to be strengthened to be able to do what needed to be done, but he had a concern. You're going to see his concern through this picture here, his concern for other people. Even when he gets onto the island, what do you see him do? He guides, he directs the others. He heals. He heals those that have needs. So you see this, again, a concern for the needs of others. He seeks out that relationship with them. Now, of course, his purpose of healing is more than one fold, because he's also teaching the gospel to them. And we go back to Mark 16, verse 20. And one of the ways that the individual was put forth as a preacher of the gospel was the fact that he was able to do miraculous things. And so this is going to confirm Paul to them and even to these men that are on board this ship. But again, these things are happening, and Paul's working with these things, taking advantage of the opportunity to do the things that... Need to be done here. But without a doubt, these individuals are afraid of their life, afraid for losing their lives. 34. Wherefore I pray you, Paul said, take some meat, for this is your health, for there shall not a hair fall from the head of any of you. So Paul's advice is good advice. Now, here he says, take some meat, get some strength, you need your health. Not a hair shall fall from any of you. What does that mean? No harm? Have we ever heard a phrase like that in the Bible before this? I think you find a phrase very close to this in Matthew chapter 10, verse 30. It's actually spoken by Jesus. Let's read the text. Matthew 10, 30. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. What does that phrase that Jesus spoke teach us? God knows all there is to know about what? About our individual lives. About me, as Carl put it. And so here again, you see, as Paul makes this statement that not a hair of your head shall come to any harm, he's telling them that individually they're going to be all right. Individually, all of them are going to be able to go to safety and be able to survive this storm. So this is a great word that Paul has given to them here. Very comforting word. Now, let's get the picture. What have they done for 14 days? Suffered. They've suffered. They've not eaten. The storm is going on. The storm's still raging. While Paul speaks here, the storm is raging so much that they've tried to separate from the ship, for the shipmen have tried to get in the boat and separate from the ship. But Paul tells them, and he's telling them all the way through this, now you're going to be all right. Paul is the sole comforting word on board the ship. Now, is there anything that has happened that would cause that comforting word of Paul to have some force to it? All right, up to this point, everything that Paul has said has come true, and that confirms to the listener that Paul has some message, some direction from God, doesn't he? And so Paul here comes and sets forth this, that they're going to be all right, and he literally brings some comfort and peace to these people that are on board this ship. Now, he encourages them to stop and eat. All right, 35. And when he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all, which when he had broken it, he began to eat. Paul does two or three things here very quickly. Number one, he takes bread. What does that mean? All right, he goes gets food. He's going to prepare to eat. Secondly, what does he do? Thanks God for the meal, for the food. in front of everyone. All right, now I want you to stop and think. Who was present on the ship? What? Mostly heathen. Let's go a little farther with it. Luke, well, we know Luke and Aristarchus was there. They're the other Christians on board that we know that are there. Who else we know there? Soldiers. We have Roman soldiers coming out of Roman paganism and the centurion. They're on board. Who else is on board? Got the other prisoners on board, the other convicts. Got the ship crew, and the ship's from Egypt, so you've got Egyptians on board, which are probably, again, very paganistic in their beliefs, if they believe in anything at all. And so here you've got, just look at the crowd that's before Paul, and he does what? And he stops and does that by praying, a giving of thanks to God in front of all of them. Brethren, little do we know the power of a prayer of thanksgiving at the proper time. You know, I got to thinking about this, and Matthew 15:36 came to mind. And as you go back here, and this is going to talk about Jesus, just know what Jesus does here, Matthew 15:36. Okay. Said, and he took 7 loaves and fishes. Remember this? And gave thanks and broke them and gave them to his disciples and his disciples to the multitude. Who was in front of Jesus when he gave that thanks? All right, verse 38. You're on both sides of it, Bob. 4,000. All right. So here Jesus feeds the 4,000. Who are these 4,000 made up of? Some Jews, yeah. Just people that followed Jesus out in the wilderness, wasn't it? And he did what? He stopped and gave thanks. John 6:11. You find Jesus here in the presence of his disciples. And again, he stops and he gives thanks. Jesus took the loaves. When he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples. He stops here and gives thanks again. Friends, a word of thanksgiving can be a lesson teacher. And I don't know that we think about that much. I know in our modern society, sometimes it is difficult for us to stop and have thanksgiving before we partake of a meal. Matter of fact, it's getting more and more common, even among Christian people, that we get so tied up in getting the meal that we don't even stop and give thanks. That ought not be. Shouldn't be that way. That says a great deal about us and our perception of thanksgiving before the world. Now, I know the world sometimes isn't happy when the Christian stops and gives thanks. You notice, I don't know, years ago, if you would eat out, it was not uncommon to see somebody give thanks before a meal. That's gotten less and less and less. It's gotten less against with our brethren, too. Now, listen to me carefully. You don't give thanks to be seen of men. But you don't withhold the giving of thanks because men are present. It should be our purpose to give thanks to the Lord God of heaven, and the presence of others should not prevent us from doing so, if it's a time that we normally do. You got enough Bible evidence in what we've already looked at to demonstrate that. Okay, so Paul here's again, while he's not preached a great lesson by his life, he's lived a great lesson right in front of them. And the lesson he's lived in front of them is a lesson of where do these blessings come from? The one true God of heaven. And he stops and he thanks the one true God of heaven for that which he has given to him here. Okay, verse 36. They broke it and they began to eat. 36. Then they were all of good cheer, and they also took some meat. Who's they? All the rest of them. Now, think with me for a minute. What has caused the rest of them to be of good cheer? They believed Paul's message, didn't they? And believing Paul's message, they become of good cheer, and they do what? They eat. My friends, that should be the influence of the Christian upon other people. The gospel is the gospel of salvation, not the gospel of condemnation. I know that the world perceives it as the gospel of condemnation, but it is not. Matter of fact, is in John 3, verse 17, I believe it is, it makes the point that for Christ came not into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through Him might be. Why did He not come into the world to condemn the world? It was already condemned. What brought condemnation upon the world? Man's sins. Jesus Christ didn't come into the world to condemn the world. He didn't have to. Matter of fact, is if God wanted the world to be condemned and Jesus Christ wanted the world to be condemned, then Christ would not have come to the world and the world would have been condemned. That's the Bible's picture. We need some way to teach the gospel's message so that people can see that it's not a message of condemnation, but it is a message of salvation. That's what it's about. So Paul here, in presenting these things, and as he has presented them, they are looking, no doubt, in a physical sense, but he's told them that God's going to spare them. They're not going to die. They're physically not going to die. They have become relieved of that somewhat, and because of their relief from that, they're able to eat. They're able to partake of the normal things that the body should partake of because they're no longer worried. They're no longer troubled. They're not bothered to the same degree that they were before Paul addressed this matter. Okay, so they took some meat, 37. And we were all in the ship, 200, 3 score, 16 souls, 276. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and cast out the wheat into the sea. Now, you can infer a few things in this verse. What has been thrown out before this? Tackling the ship, the baggage, the everything else that's unnecessary. So, here at this point, they eat their fill. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. What were they eating? Probably wheat. Because after they eat their fill, that they cast the wheat into the sea. The wheat might have been both cargo and food. It was not uncommon to transfer entire shiploads of wheat in this day and time. And it might be that the wheat is the cargo, but it's also what they've eaten. Anyway, they throw that out into the sea. Now, what's left on a ship once you've thrown your food out? The passengers. That's about all that's left. That's right. Now, once they've thrown the food out, what does that require of the ship? You've got to go to shore. And you've got to go to shore in the short term. Do you not? And so here, as they've thrown the food out, this shows a possible acceptance of what Paul has said. What has Paul told them? They're not going to be harmed. They're going to wind up on an island. All of them are going to be healthy. And so here they throw this. Why do they throw the wheat out? And if they lighten the load, and this again shows you there's probably a quantity of this wheat. They didn't just take a bushel basket of wheat and throw it overboard. They threw a large quantity of wheat over, trying to do what to the ship? All right, so it wouldn't draft as deep. It would make the ship lighter, make it where it would float higher up. Why would they want it floating higher up? All right, they were afraid of it running aground. And so they lighten the ship here. So when morning comes, they've done all these things, hoping that they can get not only the people alive, but that they can save the ship. The number one concern at this point is the salvation of people's lives. That's number one. The number two concern for the ship captain is what? Save that ship. I mean, he's responsible for it. If it's the owner, it's his livelihood. Okay, that's where they're at. Verse 39. And when it was day, they knew not the land. Why didn't they know it? They didn't have any idea where they were. They were from Alexandria in Egypt. Where were they going? Going to Rome, and they're out past where they needed to go north to go to Rome, so they're out in an area probably they've not been in before. All right. And you got to remember, in that day and time, these people, these men that sailed the ships, they got to where they could recognize a land. That was their basic identification of where they were. When they could see land, they would recognize certain points, certain peaks, certain rivers, certain streams, certain beaches and things. They could tell you where they were if they could just get close enough to see land, if it was places that they normally travel. They didn't know where they were. Is the force of the point. Okay. They knew not the land, but they discovered a certain creek with a shore, and into which they were minded, if possible, to thrust the ship. Creek indicating a deeper area, they wanted to put the ship in there. When they'd taken up anchors, the four in the back, they committed themselves into the sea, loosed the rudder bands, hoisted up the mainsail to the wind, and made toward shore. All right, so here's as they get ready to go toward shore, they've got their spot selected. All right, they committed themselves, they take up the anchors, they commit themselves, they loose the rudder bands. What does that mean? Huh? Now, where do they steer? Why have they had the rudder banded? And what way has it been headed all night? It's been anchored to the rear. It's been headed toward shore all night. Remember, they've thrown four anchors out, hoping they would hold, waiting on daylight. And they've kept that rudder to keep that ship as straight as they can so that the waves would as much as possible pass it. If that ship turned sideways, what would happen? It was done. And so they loose the rudder band so that the man on the rudder can steer the ship. And they hoisted up the mainsail to the wind. Why the mainsail? They're going to have power, plus it's going to assist them in guiding it. So they've made all the preparations to try to get to the proper place. They want to go in where this creek runs. Okay, 41. And falling into a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground. What happened to them? They hit bottom, but what's going on outside the ship? You got force from two different directions on the ship. It says place where two seas met. So you've got movement, two currents, one from one side, one from the other side. So you got two different currents hitting the ship, batting the ship back and forth like this. And the ship's aground. So what's happening to the back of the ship? It starts out moving back and forth until finally the waves of the two seas are so strong that it begins to... So... Where is everybody on the ship? Everybody's run to the front. So you got all 276 people running to the front of the ship and the back of the ship breaking up. Things are serious. Deadly serious at this point. I can't even imagine. You know, as we read this, I try to imagine what's going on in the mind of those individuals and try to imagine the fear that's going on board. And, you know, Paul has said, all of you going to escape it. But with the forefront of that ship stuck on ground, the back of that ship flying apart, the seas beating it from two sides, I begin to doubt Paul's word here. How can we all be saved with all these things going on? Now, I didn't bring all that up to bring doubt. Because from all of that doubt, what's going to come? They're going to be saved, and then what's that done to Paul's word? It's confirmed Paul as a spokesman of truth. It confirms Paul as having received that message from God himself. And so all of the things that's going on here is for confirmation. And it's going to confirm the very things that Paul has set forth. All right, 42. And the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. Now, with all of this going on, these soldiers begin to talk. And what they're talking about what they need to do with the prisoners. What is the collective decision about what needs to be done with the prisoners? Kill them. And that's what the soldiers have determined. Why would the soldiers determine to kill the prisoners? Huh? Okay, Roman law again. If they allow them to escape, then the soldiers that were to be holding them would have the punishment placed upon them. We see this back in Acts the 16th chapter also, verse 27. You've got the Philippian jailer, and that night of the Philippian jailer, when the earthquake and the cells were open, what did the jailer do? He rose up to take his sword to take his own life. Why did he want to take his own life? Okay? And again, it would be easier than suffering the punishment of those who had escaped. So you see this same thing here. The soldiers have talked among themselves, and they have determined to kill all of the prisoners so that they will not suffer any reprisal from the government for allowing them to escape. Boy, this is harsh. You think about how but you see it in the nature of the time, in the nature of the people. These soldiers, not wanting to suffer this punishment, are willing to murder these prisoners rather than risk punishment themselves. That shows us how dire the Roman system was. They did not want to suffer what these prisoners were going to suffer or what they were suffering. Now, there's one exception to these soldiers making this. Verse 43. But the centurion, willing to save Paul, kept them from their purpose. Now, you got all the soldiers wanting to do one thing, but here's the old commander. What does he say? Not going to do it. Now, Luke here, by inspiration, is told the mind of the centurion. The centurion's purpose was saving Paul. To save Paul's life, he gives this order. I don't know. I guess so, if he gave the order. I mean, that's only possible conclusion you could come to. Well, the problem of doing that is under Roman law, then they'd be guilty of that. Would probably be punishable by death too, turning on the commander. So it's a tough situation that occurs here. It's not easy. What goes on is not an easily resolved thing. Of course, he is the ranking commander on the ship. Okay, so we're told his purpose here, and it's a righteous purpose. Paul has done him no harm. Matter of fact is, this centurion's probably the same one's been with Paul since he left Caesarea. And when he got up to Sidon, what did he do with Paul? Yeah, go. He let Paul to go refresh himself with his friends. So this centurion has known Paul through all of the things that has happened. What if Paul had just been a prisoner that was gruff and rough and kept his mouth shut? What if Paul had been a prisoner that was reserved and would not teach the things of Christ? Probably lost his life here. The things that preserved his life were the qualities that he demonstrated in the fact that God talked to him and he was revealing the will of God. It was Paul's goodness that caused the centurion to command them not to put them to death. Okay, so again, you come back to the example that Paul has left here. All right, he commanded that they could that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to land, and the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land. And so here the commander tells them how he wants it done. He tells them, says, if you can swim, you go first. Those that can't swim, grab a hold of something and get to land in that way. So that was the commandment that was given. A commandment, abandon the ship, go to the land. And the centurion was evidently the one that told them to do this at the last time. Now, Paul was God's messenger. God had assured him that he would go to Rome. His trip to Rome was filled with trials and tribulations, pains. His trip to Rome was filled with suffering. In this account of the 27th chapter, you do not find great doctrinal teachings by Paul. You don't find an oration where he explains great deals of details about the depth of God's love or God's greatness. But what does he do? He shows. He demonstrates. He simply lives the Christian life before those that he is around on this ship. His word is confirmed by the fact that God has spoken to him and that the things that God speaks to him comes to be true. But you get a great, great lesson about living the Christian life out of this chapter and what the value of it is. All right, let's look at our questions. We got a few questions.